Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 254, we have a traditional journal club. I'm joined by Drs. Nika Bagheri, Daniel Chow, and Priya Vakaria for a group discussion of four recent articles in major ophthalmology journals. We discuss topics ranging from the PIVOT trial and patient quality of life measures in patients receiving pneumatic retinopexy versus vitrectomy. We then discuss gender differences in retinal detachment repair. We then turn to an analysis of subretinal fluid and artificial intelligence identification of subretinal fluid and neovascular age-related macular degeneration versus experienced physician. And we end with a discussion of cost savings with the use of anti-VEGF agents in the United States. You can find a list of all the articles we will discuss in the episode description. You can also find our financial disclosures in the episode description and a link to go to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website and claim CME credits for this episode and many other episodes. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by three retina specialists for this journal club. First in alphabetical order, Dr. Nika Bagheri from Southern California, part of California Retina Consultants. Nika, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Next, Dr. Daniel Chow from University of California, San Diego. Dan, welcome.
Thanks, Jay.
And last but not least, Dr. Priya Vakaria from the Retina Group of Washington in Washington, D.C.
Thanks for having me, Jay. Good to be back.
It's good. It's good to have everyone back. I'm always impressed when I can get three people's alphabetical order right when I don't pre-plan. So that was good. And so this will be a journal club looking at articles published within the last kind of month to 2 months in major ophthalmology journals. All these articles, we'll put the link to the PubMed link in the episode description. And the first article we're going to discuss was published in JAMA Ophthalmology. The title is Vision-Related Functioning in Patients Undergoing Pneumatic Retinopexy versus Vitrectomy for Primary Rickmatogenous Retinal Detachment. This is a post hoc exploratory analysis of the PIVOT randomized clinical trial. First author, Rajiv Mooney. Priya, tell us a little bit about what this study set out to show and what they showed.
Sure thing. So this is a post hoc analysis of the PIVOT trial. The PIVOT trial was where patients were randomized to either pneumatic retinopexy or parsplan vitrectomy in patients who had a rickmatogenous retinal detachment with either a single break or multiple breaks that were within 1 clock hour, but the breaks had to be in the superior quadrants, the superior 8 clock hours of the retina. And so these patients were randomized to vitrectomy versus pneumatic retinopexy, but this article specifically is a post hoc analysis looking at the NEI, the National Eye Institute Visual Function Questionnaire in these patients. And so the goal of this article was to explore the different aspects of postoperative vision-related quality amongst these trial patients to see if there was a difference between those patients who were randomized to pneumatic retinopexy and those patients who were randomized to parsplan vitrectomy. And so there were a total of 160 patients in this analysis, with 81 patients or 92% in the pneumatic retinopexy group and 79 patients or 90% in the parsplan vitrectomy group. And they looked at the NEI VSQ at three time frames, at 3 months, 6 months, and 1 year. At 3 months, there was a significantly increased evidence of, for the patients who had the pneumatic retinopexy, they had a superior composite score on the NEI VFQ as compared to vitrectomy, not only overall, but also in multiple different categories. There were like 8 different categories, including visual functioning, general vision, peripheral vision, mental health, rural difficulties, dependency, et cetera. At 6 months, the pneumatic retinopexy group also outperformed the parsplan vitrectomy group in respects to distance activities, mental health, dependency, and peripheral vision. But there was no difference in these groups at 1 year. And so their summary was that pneumatic retinopexy patients had much improved quality of vision and kind of a mental health and these things, subjective findings on the NEI VSQ to suggest that although there's no difference at 1 year, that in the short term, pneumatic retinopexy patients overall had better subjective measurements.
Great summary and a lot to unpack here. Dan, I'll start with you first. You know, What are kind of the strengths of a study like this? And then what are some of the limitations, for example, of using this sort of questionnaire?
I think it was a very well done study. I mean, if you look at the PIVOT trial, I think it was very thoughtfully designed, especially as we all know, with all the inherent difficulties of designing a prospective surgical trial. This post hoc analysis was really nice because, you know, if we're trying to look at measures of visual function, the NEI BFQ-25 is actually, there's a lot of literature behind that, that it's quite validated as detecting changes in a patient's visual function. So I think in sense of academically determining whether patients are really noticing some functional changes, I think definitely it's very good at picking this up because, you know, we really don't have very many metrics that measure these types of things. One thought that I have, and I don't think it's necessarily related to the designer of the study itself, is, one thing is in terms of interpreting 25, but I'm wondering if there's really any instance where we have actually made, changed our clinical practice or really taken that data into account in terms of treatment decisions. I think at this point, we don't really know, at least as retina specialists, how to really evaluate it in a more practical standpoint, except for academically, there seems to be a difference. And, I think how we interpret and use these functional questionnaires, I think is still very much in its infancy.
Nika, your thoughts and reactions to anything Dan or Priya stated so far?
So, the thing I like about this is that it's really pushing us to do our job and advocate for our patients and try and look at how we can improve their quality of life. I do think it's very important to have many tools in our toolbox so that we can get the best customized care and the best possible care. I agree it's good data and they did a great discussion. It's always tricky to have any surgical data, and we do know it's not really apples to apples, and the authors acknowledge that. I think it'd be interesting to know more about the macular status, for example, when they talk about things like contrast or distortion in the vision. We don't have data on that. And the authors do mention that 35% of the patients in the vitrectomy group had C3 effect gas, for example, versus F6. So, I would expect the vitrectomy patients not to have been good pneumatic candidates and have maybe more challenging pathology, like a vitreous hemorrhage, or not be as compliant. I did find it very reassuring that there were no differences in the groups at 1 year. So that was kind of a point that...
No, that's a great point. I mean, the 6-month difference did disappear at 1 year. And one of the things they brought up in the discussion was whether proximity to surgery, I'm sure, plays some role in how people fill out these questionnaires. Surgery is obviously, quote unquote, a more traumatic event, both literally, but maybe psychologically for someone to go through, especially if you have a long-acting gas bubble, you're not really seeing much. And it's interesting that quality of life difference kind of disappeared at a year. Priya, any other thoughts before we move on from this paper?
No, I thought that was an excellent summary so far. And I think this just kind of supports that from a patient's perspective, having a more rapid visual recovery can be something that they're really looking for and can definitely help with other qualities of life.
So our next paper we're going to review is Sex Differences in the Repair of Retinal Detachments in the United States. This was published online in the American Journal of Ophthalmology in June. And interestingly, it's so early, and I think journals are so inundated with, this is a separate conversation, but with articles with during the COVID-19 pandemic. They haven't even actually put this, I'm sure we're all looking at a similar PDF. It's kind of the original proofs that we're all reading. So there's a lot to unpack here. Then the senior authors are Natalia Calloway, and then I was first author, and Darius Moshfeghi, the senior author. Nick, you want to tell us a little bit about what this study was designed to show and what they showed?
Yes. So this was a retrospective cohort study, and they're looking simply at sex differences between men and women for regmatogenous retinal detachment. They use a large insurance claims database called the Truven Health Market Scan, and to query any claims for regmatogenous detachment from 2007 to 2015. And this is a database that spans all the states and many different kinds of insurance groups. They looked at baseline characteristics like sex, age, and the year the surgery was performed. And they also looked at some other comorbidities including myopia, pseudophakia, lattice, and vitreous hemorrhage, so they could use those in their modeling as predictor variables. And then they looked at the type of surgical intervention and categorized that according to pneumatic retinopexy, parsplanar vitrectomy, laser barricade, or scleral buckle. So in their primary outcome, they were just looking at the odds ratio of surgical intervention for women compared to men after controlling for the baseline characteristics and comorbidities. And their secondary outcomes, they looked at the time to repair after the diagnosis was made, the type of surgical intervention, and importantly, they looked at the rate of reoperation. So the statistics were with multiple logistic regression models, and they looked at over 133 million records. Of those, around 61,000 had inclusion criteria, and they did their best to try to exclude more complex detachments by essentially eliminating diabetic patients or patients with retinopathy of prematurity or sickle cell or scesis or trauma or chorioretinitis. Out of their records, they had about 43% women, 26,000 or so, and they found that women had a reduced odd of having surgical repair after they adjusted for their confounders, and that their surgery was more often delayed. The women that did have surgery more likely to have laser barricade or a primary scleral buckle or pneumatic retinopexy than men. One thing that I thought was also helpful is the odds of reoperation were lower in women in this study.
Great, great summary. And again, a lot to discuss and unpack here. Priya, do you want to take first crack? Anything else that stood out to you when Nico was describing the results when you read this paper?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing that stood out to me the most was the overall repair rate of 63.1% amongst all subjects, which seems very low. Now, they did say this is consistent with prior epidemiologic evaluations, but that at the very least gives me pause to say, what else is going on here? Are we missing some data? Is some data inaccurately coded? Is there something else going on that's leading, that's confounding this? I find it hard to believe that out of the whole database of retina specialists that, 35% of retinal detachments are not getting operated on at all. But other than that, as Nika said, they definitely showed a gender discrepancy in the rate of retinal detachment repair and in the rate of reoperation. And they don't really offer a good reasoning for this. And obviously they can't in this study. This is purely just looking at the data from the Truven database. But I don't really have a good idea why, unless it is that, females really do have other one of the things the authors say is that females oftentimes are caretakers and have other things that they have to do. And so they, since they carry such a significant burden, they try to avoid or delay medical care. But I think the biggest thing I'd want elaboration on is why is there a 63.1% repair rate amongst all retinal detachments?
Yeah, that's a great point. I have my thoughts on that, but Dan, I'll let you go first.
Sure. So I think it's a really interesting first study in the effect of sex on surgical repair. The authors report that there have been some other studies similarly that have actually found sex differences in surgical procedures, particularly in the cardiac field, which is somewhat interesting. I think the one thing, I think as Priya said, it's unclear what, there might be some idiosyncrasies of just this claimed data that could be kind of obscuring what's going on. I think the authors did a really good job of making sure they were utilizing the claims database to the best they could in terms of using four different models to really make sure that the results were consistent in terms of trying to figure out coding issues within the database. One thing that I found was interesting was that they stated 20% in terms of the initial diagnosing provider, 20% of them were retina specialists. So I wonder in terms of that handoff between the original referrer and the retina specialist, what's kind of happening there? Is that somehow contributing to that? And what is the time between seeing the person who made the initial diagnosis and the retina specialist? And, you know, does that play at all into the 63.1% repair?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I think that they brought up in the introduction that this is an important issue in medicine. It's been, Priya said, it's been acknowledged in other fields. So I applaud the authors for looking at this issue. And I think their models and everything they did in terms of analyzing the data was fantastic. I just think, Priya, you hit the nail on the head, and Dan, you commented, and Nikki, I'll get your thoughts as well. But I just think it's, just, if I was a reviewer, and I always think when I'm reading this, like when I'm writing a paper, if I was a reviewer, what I would say, if I was reading it, what I would say. I mean, my concern is you can have the best analysis in the world. It's really, really hard to derive any conclusions when you start from that point. And again, I want to trust them when they say that's consistent with other epidemiologic data. But three of us have already commented. I'm the third one, and I don't know what epidemiological data they're referring to. They didn't add a reference there. So my point is, there may be a difference. They may not be. I just don't know if this tells us enough. This definitely tells us maybe this is worth more evaluation with a better kind of search. But there's got to be something built into this that confuses the issue, because it's really hard to say women have a lower rate. I'm sure they do statistically significant. You can see how it's modeled. But we don't know where that over a third of patients, men and women, is going. Nika, any thoughts or any theories on what could have happened here?
Yes, you know, so I agree that the most striking point is that nearly 37 patients did not get surgery. And I think it's probably more of a more detail and more exploration from the insurance side and the coding side. You know, this Truven scan, they have over 350 different insurance carriers. So while they're saying that these patients are insured, we all know that insurance coverage is not equal. So they might not have the same benefits or the same coverage. Also, we don't know how they did the codes. They mentioned, you know, the CPT codes, but there's different codes for lasering. So perhaps some patients got laser, but it wasn't the type of laser code that they used when they pulled the data. I do agree with Dan as well in terms of the patients that were seen. Only 21% of them were seen by a retina specialist, and we know that the retina specialist did the surgery. So, you know, if they were seen by an optometrist or a different eye care provider, we don't know how those patients were ultimately provided access or sent to a retina specialist for surgery. So I think there's a lot of real world issues here that would benefit from being uncovered. I was very happy to see that there weren't more reops in women. And, you know, the authors acknowledged that the delay, which was around a day, wasn't really clinically significant for them. I think the rest of it's in line with what we would expect. You know, a lady who is younger with lattice and myopia is more likely to be a better scleral buckle candidate than an older gentleman that has vitreous hemorrhage, you know, and is pseudophakic and, you know, maybe would be a higher PVR risk. So I thought the types of treatment approaches made sense. It's just, there's a lot of questions here about the access for patients, men and women.
Yeah. I mean, you guys made great points about how the data was captured, right? So I think this paper shows something important, but I think maybe we would all agree you should rephrase what this paper shows is that of patients who are diagnosed, I mean, this is most of the time not by retina specialists, assuming a referring doctor, women are less likely to have surgical repair than men. That doesn't mean that they actually have retinal detachments. There could be other reasons, you know. Maybe women are more likely to have a retinal detachment misdiagnosed, for example, referred, and then they don't need surgery. I mean, there's a lot of things that could underlie that. So any other thoughts, Priya or Dan, before we move on to the next paper?
Jay, I was going to echo what you said. You know, part of what I was wondering is, are women actually more likely to seek care, which is, you know, kind of, that's what most people think, that women generally are more likely to seek care, whereas men delay it. Yeah, you know, that's kind of what the general thought is. But so maybe women are more likely to seek care, or they were misdiagnosed with retinal detachments, and then when they saw the retina specialist, they were found to not have one. And so that could explain part of this, and that could also explain the low rate of surgery overall. That's my only thought here.
Dan, any final thoughts?
Just to add, I think this brings up a whole really interesting field in terms of, yeah, sex differences in medical care. And if we just look in ophthalmology, you know, I think looking, there's surgical repair, there's diabetic follow-ups, and I think certainly it's a field ripe for investigation, and I certainly applaud the authors for plunging into this field.
Well, without further ado, we have not yet had what everyone's waiting for, which is Dan Chow's breakdown of article, which is Priya and Nika did amazing jobs. So Dan, you have big shoes to fill right now. I don't know if I'd want to follow those two. But your article, the next article discussed from ophthalmology, is retinal specialist versus artificial intelligence detection of retinal fluid from OCT. This was an A-RED study, 10-year follow-on study by Keenan et al. And then Dan, after you finish your evaluation, I'm going to have my AI algorithm do its own evaluation of this article, and then we'll do it head-to-head, and we'll see whether retina specialist or AI algorithm was better. But Dan, tell us about this article.
Yeah, I think first of all, just with the fluid presentations by Priya and Nika, it can only go down from here. So here, you know, we're looking at a very interesting study. This is a prospective comparison of analysis of fluid from, this is from the A-RED 10-year follow-up. So in terms of the A-RED study, this was a single visit 5 years after the end of the study. And interestingly enough, at this evaluation, investigators are supposed to grade whether they saw intraretinal fluid or subretinal fluid. And so this grading was done many years ago. And then now there was a comparison with an AI algorithm. It's called the NOTAL OCT Analyzer. This is from NOTAL Vision. You know, interesting enough, this has been studied in two previous papers, one in ophthalmology in 2016, where they validated this algorithm and showed that there was a very high concordance in terms of determination of fluid compared to three retina specialists. And then there was also a presentation at the AAO where they did a larger data set, a retrospective data set with a comparison of retina specialists to the AI algorithm. And so this was a very large prospective study of over 1,100 eyes. And there are essentially two tasks. The investigators were needed to report whether there was a presence of intraretinal fluid or subretinal fluid, which they did as part of the study. And then this AI algorithm then did the same thing at this time point. And the interesting thing was that the AI algorithm actually outperformed the retina specialist, the study investigator, in terms of looking at the different metrics. The specificity was, you know, similar, but still higher in the AI algorithm for most parts of the fluid. But it was really the sensitivity that was quite different. In the retina specialist, they had a 46% sensitivity rate versus the AI, which was in the 90%. And I think that's really where this difference occurred. They also did some analysis between intraretinal fluid and subretinal fluid, which was, you know, more or less congruent in the subretinal fluid. There was a higher specificity of the investigators compared to the AI algorithm, but still a lower amount of sensitivity. And when you look at the particular images where the AI algorithm outperformed the investigators, I should say for the ground truth, they used the reading center. And so if you look at those that the investigators did not get, they did tend to be more difficult images to read, determined by the fact that at reading center, they many times needed to go to a third senior reader to determine the read for that. But, you know, overall, this was a very large prospective study and very nicely designed and really definitively showed that that this AI algorithm certainly was much more sensitive in detecting fluid, which is, you know, quite interesting. I think the thing that stood out for me was that, wow, the AI algorithms have come a long way. You know, I remember in residency, people were always trying to develop automated algorithms, and really the segmentation analysis was still quite difficult. But, you know, it seems like at least some of these AI algorithms are solving this and can even, you know, detect the intraretinal fluid versus subretinal fluid, at least at the accuracy of retina specialists, and perhaps even better. And so I think it's a really interesting study and may suggest that we are closer than we think in terms of AI tools as an adjunct and assistant to the retina specialist in clinical care.
Wonderful summary. Nika, any thoughts on anything Dan said or this article or the idea of artificial intelligence? Are we going to be seeing more of this in our clinics, you think, over the next 5 to 10 years?
I think so. You know, I think as technology evolves, we're going to need to learn how to best harness it to benefit the patient. And I agree with the points that Dan were making, and that the cases that were complex were the ones that were more challenging. Those are the ones where, you know, those are the ones that I imagine would be in our conference about where the fluid is and how to approach these. So those are the ones that are standardized in some ways by the artificial intelligence. And I think it's important to challenge our biases on this. The authors did a really good discussion, very, very valuable, and raising the point about how we can use this as a diagnostic tool, just like, you know, the topography map for glaucoma, just to add better breadth and depth and help us patients.
I think artificial intelligence is one of those things that's only going to help us in our practice. And one of the biggest things here is the AI algorithm is such a, and they even pointed it out here, retina specialists in general are not the same as the retina specialists that are doing the study. These are retina specialists who are doing the clinical trial, who are analyzing these scans, looking at every single B scan, looking for fluid, debating it. But in reality, in real life, you kind of scan through the OCT really quickly and then you make your decision. And so AI can only help us to make the best decision for our patients, not only in the retina setting, but also in the comprehensive ophthalmology setting. And so I think that I'm very excited to see how this is going to be integrated into practice in the future.
Yeah, I would just say that it'd be unrealistic to look at what the data that's coming out and all the studies and expect things not to change. I feel very much that we're in a similar situation, Dan, and Nika commented on the complexity issue. We're very much in a similar situation to how retina specialists may have felt in the early mid 2000s about OCT and say, well, you know, what is this really changing? This is a clinical diagnosis. Well, once we start using treatments that depend on those subtle differences, then that becomes important. And right now we have treatments that depend on those subtle differences in complex cases. And we may have more permanent treatments. We may want to detect this before our eyes can detect it. Maybe the algorithm can detect certain patterns that predict the subretinal fluid will develop. I mean, that's not what this paper is about, but you can imagine that with a large enough database, the artificial intelligence algorithm can learn what are kind of the predictors. So instead of giving someone an Amsler grid and watching them and watching them closely, for example, if they have dry disease or kind of wet disease, it's quote unquote currently dormant, you wonder if we're going to be able to kind of predict things. Minority Report, Dan. I don't know if we're going to have precogs, but we're definitely going to have a lot more availability. That's our pop culture reference for this evening, by the way. Yeah. Any final thoughts, Dan, before we move to the last article?
Well, no, I was just thinking about your comment there, like with Minority Report, and then just following up on that pop culture reference, I'm thinking of the movie Gattaca, where they use genetics and this kind of similar type of thing. But you can imagine, if you know, we get good enough, we can predict someone's rate of getting, say, macular degeneration based on their OCT when they're 20, and then are they allowed to be pilots? And you know, so there's all kinds of moral quandaries with this kind of premonition.
That's true. You can imagine residency applications one day. We might test them to see, well, you have a 66% chance of reconsidering your career goals in the next 4 years based on your genetics. So. I don't know if this is the best fit for you. Yeah, I don't know. It is a slippery slope for sure. But thankfully, we're not at the near the top of that slope right now. So that's good. The last article we're going to talk about was this article by Brown, Rapuano, and Boyer in AJO, a cost-benefit analysis of VEGF inhibitor therapy for neovascular age-related macular degeneration in the United States. This is published in AJO Online. Again, these articles are coming out so fast that this is a proofs-only type of version. But just to summarize, and I'll take this one since expectations have been raised so high, I can only dash them. This essentially compared bevacizumab, ranibizumab, and aflibercept for treating a neovascular AMD using published clinical trial data and Medicare data. They looked at 168,000 plus U.S. patients in 2018 with new onset AMD, and then used the dollar values and to figure out a cost-benefit analysis for each drug. And then looked ahead for 11 years and extrapolated for 11 years what would be the cost. And that's including the cost of direct therapy, the non-medical impact of a patient, for example, losing vision, productivity for these patients, and what was saved by these therapies. And just to break it down, I mean, all of these are extremely good investments is the way they phrased it. which makes sense given the vision that they save and the productivity they save. And this is not even getting into the, you know, quality of life and happiness quotient. This is simply from a dollars and cents component. And they increase national wealth with this fantastic. The big take-home message is over 11 years, they contribute about $12.2 billion to the GDP. If late treatment would decrease this value, I mean, if you delayed treatment at all, you would decrease this by over 75%, 78%, which lines up with the letters you kind of lose if you delay treatment in a patient with new-onset neovascular AMD. Unsurprisingly, the return on investment is highest for bevacizumab, which is the lowest cost treatment, and the ranibizumab and aflibercept are less than that, ranking in order from most expensive to least expensive, ranibizumab, aflibercept, and bevacizumab. And I will mention my disclosures, they'll be listed in the episode description, but I do have a disclosure for Regeneron, but that is not applicable to this discussion, but I'll, in the purposes of transparency, I'll mention that. So these type of analyses, the models always make me realize that I'm not nearly as smart as sometimes I'm led to believe by a compliment. I definitely don't quite understand everything in the model, though I read through and they really mapped it out. But I'm going to kind of weave my way back, Dan, since we ended with you. These sort of cost-benefit analyses, I think, are interesting because they kind of take away the human side of medicine, but they're actually really, really important, potentially, from a policy perspective. So, I mean, do these dollar values surprise you? Or is this like monopoly money where it's like, wow, this is so much more than I would predict? Or is this kind of in line with what you would expect?
Well, you know, I think this just hints at, again, the not only, you know, the quality of life that good vision provides is, you know, matched up with the proportional financial benchmark when you're looking at, when you're benchmarking it to other medical conditions that reduce quality of life. You know, I think it's always very staggering when you see these into numbers like this, but you know, given the high prevalence of these diseases, you know, I guess it's not surprising. I don't really, you know, have a good grasp in terms of, you know, how this benchmarks to other things. But, you know, I think bottom line, vision is important and also economically important as well. And then again, you mentioned the bevacizumab. You know, of course, we know that it's not surprising that we would see an increased return on investment. And, you know, when you think about kind of the biggest impacts that ophthalmology has perhaps had on U.S. government policy, or just saving money for the government, I think certainly the use of bevacizumab, you know, has saved Medicare, you know, billions of dollars, and so it's always interesting to factor in as well.
Nika, any thoughts on, again, the amounts we're talking about here? And again, the modeling does have some limitations, like any model. There are certain costs, for example, that can't be accounted, like premium costs. They, you know, talk about the kind of, they don't have an 11-year study. They have to kind of use some real-world data and extrapolate it. And they also didn't use treat and extend data, which is obviously the most popular treatment strategy we have for these neovascular AMD patients. But I mean, any thoughts on the kind of the big takeaways about this cost savings and all these therapies being cost effective and also saving us bundles of money as a country?
Yes, I think, you know, it's all of our responsibility to be a good citizen and try to promote what's good for, you know, our society and a country. I think as physicians, our first priority is to our patients and providing the best patient care. So I think that is in a relative priority. First and foremost in our minds. And I think we all know that there are patients that are, you know, non-responders, and outside of institutions, perhaps I see this more, you know, the real world aspect is that there are some patients that don't have coverage through their insurance for medications that would probably give them a better response. So those are also very challenging as a eye care provider, if you want to give them the best quality of life and the best outcome, and they're not able to, you know, switch their medication, for example. So I think all of these, we have to have, you know, perspective to try to take care and balance everything together and in the most proper way.
Priya, you're in Washington, D.C., or it's close to you. It's right across the street. You probably, by just proximity, we're going to say you're the most politically connected person here. your thoughts on this?
Well, I think this isn't surprising, right? We know that bevacizumab is, is a much more cost-effective therapy than ranibizumab or aflibercept. And so I don't think any of this is surprising. And I do agree with Mika that we do have a responsibility to provide cost-effective care. One of my biggest criticisms of this is, you know, I'm a huge treat and extender. And so I would like to see how treat and extend factors into this data, specifically with aflibercept. Perhaps if you're giving a significantly fewer number of injections, perhaps there's an increase in, basically aflibercept will have less expenditure as compared to ranibizumab, and obviously bevacizumab will always win. But, you know, I do think that we have a responsibility to recognize that bevacizumab can work in a large subset of patients. And I think that insurance companies are also catching on. There are many insurance companies now requiring step therapy. And so this is something that's very important for us to help keep the cost of care low.
And just to backpedal from that, Priya, just for the listeners, any disclosures that you're not a...
I have no financial disclosures.
Okay, good. Because yeah. I do. So and then, you know, the one thing I'll say to qualify that, because you mentioned aflibercept, but you could make some arguments for ranibizumab. To my knowledge, and again, any of you guys educate me, correct me if you're listening, or one of you three can correct me, I don't believe that there's a head-to-head study showing that aflibercept has a better treat and extend kind of timeline or duration or durability versus ranibizumab, for example. And I don't know if we have a study that necessarily shows that versus bevacizumab that's really well powered. When we had the CAT trial that showed that there was a whatever the what was the final conclusion? What was the joke, Dan? It was not inferior. We have to count the number of negative. But my point is, we don't necessarily have that data. I think there's some anecdotal reports, Priya. But yeah, that's a great point that maybe some of these therapies would be more cost effective if you factor in treat and extend. The fact that they're this cost effective with quote unquote monthly therapy is fantastic, because there are people who treat and extend, or and there are some people who treat PRN. So just a couple caveats there. Dan, any final thoughts?
I just had, one point is that, you know, if we just kind of step back outside of the, you know, perhaps the comparative value of each of these medications, and back to the fact that, vision saving treatments, you know, are great for the economy and really are central to quality of life for patients, is that these types of studies we can bring as ammunition when we go and advocate on Capitol Hill, not only for more vision research money, but really, again, putting vision at the forefront. And you know, we have to use every modality we can to really show our representatives that you should care about vision and vision-related research.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I mean, again, this is not to denigrate pharmaceutical research and other and pharmacological agents in other fields, but we know plenty of examples in other fields where, yes, agents will save life. And that's super, super important. And the most important, like Nika says, putting the patient first. But the quantification of value may not be the same, right, in terms of functionality, because something can save a life or save someone from, from an MI, for example, or some sort of treatment. But the quality of life or functionality may be not as big impact. We all know the impact of vision. So this is, again, hugely, hugely important. That's a great point to bring up, Dan. Nika, final thoughts?
I think that they're all very great, great articles and great thoughts. So thanks for having me.
Priya, you're happy? You're satisfied? We're going to wrap up?
Yeah, I'm satisfied. I'm good. I think Dan brings up a great point that what we do is really great. We're contributing so much to society. Our patients are seeing, and I think that $12.6 billion that, you know, ophthalmologists are helping to add to the GDP is amazing. And it's pretty cool. If you sit back to think about it, we didn't have this, 30 years ago. So it's a pretty amazing time to be a retina specialist.
It is. It is also an amazing time to be an NBA basketball fan. We're recording this August, 16th, 2020, and playoffs start tomorrow. But unfortunately, I'm stuck with a Cowboys fan, a Wizards fan, and someone who likes the Lakers because Derek Fisher used to play for the Lakers. But in the interest of full democracy, everyone give me a pick to win the NBA title. Dan.
Clippers.
Priya, don't say the Cowboys.
The Mavericks. The Mavericks.
Okay. All right. That's good.
I was going to say the Cowboys next.
And Nika, I know you're picking.
I'll pick the Lakers, yeah.
And I will take the Milwaukee Bucks because I'm just different. So guys, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for everything you do. Thanks for hanging with me on this Sunday evening. You know, I know that I don't have anything better to do. I know you guys have much better things to do. So I appreciate you not leaving me here lonely. And if we'll be back with more journal clubs in the future. So I appreciate the time you guys put into this.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's RETINAPodcast.com. You'll find 254 episodes, including this one, on the website. You can subscribe by clicking on the link and entering your email address. That will get you updates on the latest episodes in your inbox as they release. You can also subscribe on the Apple Podcast app on your iPhone or on the Android app on your Android device. Remember that we are on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and you can always contact us directly at retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. We love getting feedback. Anything you can do in terms of episode ideas, what we can do better, what you think that we should stop doing, what we should do more of, we'd love to hear from you. We also appreciate all the positive reviews you leave in the App Store for the Apple Podcast and Android's apps. Many thanks to Drs. Nika Bagheri, Daniel Chow, and Priya Vakaria for their time and help with this episode. Thank yous to Mike Benicasa, Angela Chang, and Louis Kai, all physicians in their own right, all in training and still all doing their due diligence, putting these podcasts and the social media together. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here each week, and most importantly, the patient care you deliver every day. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.